This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Bird Box by Josh Mallerman. Performed by Cassandra Campbell. Sometimes I wish I were an architect so that I could dedicate a building to a person, a superstructure that broke the clouds and continued up into the abyss. And if Bird Box were made of bricks instead of letters, I'd host a ceremony, invite every shadowy memory I have, and cut the ribbon with an axe, letting everyone see for the first time that building's name. It'd be called the Debbie. Mom, Bird Box is for you. 1. Mallory stands in the kitchen, thinking. Her hands are damp. She is trembling. She taps her toe nervously on the cracked tile floor. It is early. The sun is probably only peeking above the horizon. She watches its meager light turn the heavy window drapes a softer shade of black and thinks, "That was a fog." The children sleep under chicken wire draped in black cloth down the hall. Maybe they heard her moments ago on her knees in the yard. Whatever noise she made must have traveled through the microphones, then the amplifiers that sat beside their beds. She looks to her hands and detects the subtlest sheen in the candlelight. Yes, they are damp. The morning's dew is still fresh upon them. Now, in the kitchen, Mallory breathes deep before blowing the candle out. She looks around the small room, noting the rusted utensils and cracked dishes, the cardboard box used as a garbage can, the chairs, some held together by twine. The walls are dirty, dirt from the feet and hands of the children, but older stains too. The bottom of the walls in the hall is discolored, profound purples that have dulled to brown over time. These are blood. The carpet in the living room is discolored too, no matter how hard Mallory scrubs. There are no chemicals in the house to help clean it. Long ago, Mallory filled the buckets with water from the well and, using a suit coat, worked on removing the stains from all over the house. But they refused to go away. Even those that proved less persistent remained, a shadow perhaps of their original size, but still horribly visible. A box of candles hides a blotch in the foyer. The couch in the living room sits at an awkward angle, moved there to shield two blemishes that looked like wolves' heads to Mallory. On the second floor, by the attic stairs, a pile of musty coats conceals purple scratches, embedded deep into the foot of the wall. 10 feet away is the blackest stain in the house. She does not use the far end of the home's second floor because she cannot bring herself to cross it. This was once a nice house in a nice suburb of Detroit. Once it was family ready and safe. Only half a decade ago, a real estate agent would have proudly showed it off. But this morning the windows are covered with cardboard and wood. There is no running water. A big wooden bucket sits upon the kitchen counter. It smells stale. There are no conventional toys for the children. Pieces of a wooden chair have been whittled to play the part of little people. Small faces have been painted upon them. The cupboards are bare. There are no paintings on the walls. Wires run from under the back door into the first floor bedrooms, where amplifiers alert Mallory and the children to any sounds coming from outside the house. The three of them live this way. They do not go outside for long periods of time. When they do, they are blindfolded. The children have never seen the world outside their home, not even through the windows. and Mallory hasn't looked in more than 4 years. 4 years. She does not have to make this decision today. It's October in Michigan. It's cold. A 20-mile trip on the river will be hard on the children. They may still be too young. What if one of them were to fall into the water? What would Mallory, blindfolded, do then? An accident, Mallory thinks. How horrible. After all this struggling, all this survival, to die because of an accident. Mallory looks at the drapes. She begins to cry. She wants to yell at someone. She wants to plead with anyone who might listen. This is unfair, she would say. This is cruel. She looks over her shoulder, to the kitchen entrance and the hall that leads to the children's bedroom. Beyond the doorless frame, the children sleep soundly, covered by black cloth, hidden from light and sight. They do not stir. They show no sign of being awake. Yet they could be listening to her. Sometimes, for all the pressure upon them to listen, for all the importance she's placed upon their ears, Mallory believes they can hear her think. She could wait for sunnier skies, warmth, more attention paid to the boat. She could inform the children, listen to what they have to say. Their suggestions could be good ones. Only 4 years old, but trained to listen. Able to help navigate a boat that will be piloted blindly. Marjorie would not be able to make the trip without them. She needs their ears. Could she also use their advice? At 4 years old, would they have something to say about when was the best time to leave the house forever? Slumping into a kitchen chair, Mallory fights back the tears. Her shoeless toe still taps on the faded linoleum. Slowly, she looks up to the top of the cellar stairs. There she once talked with a man named Tom about a man named Don. She looks to the sink, where Don once carried buckets of well water, trembling for having been outdoors. Leaning forward, she can see the foyer, where Cheryl used to prepare the food for the birds. And between herself and the front door is the living room, silent and dark, where there are too many memories of too many people to digest. 4 years, she thinks, and wants to smash her fist through the wall. Mallory knows that 4 years can easily become 8. 8 will quickly become 12. And then the children will be adults. Adults who have never seen the sky, never looked out a window. What would 12 years of living like veal do to their minds? Is there a point, Mallory wonders, where the clouds in the sky become unreal, and the only place they'll ever feel at home is behind the black cloth of their blindfolds? Mallory swallows hard and imagines raising them by herself until they are teens. Could she even do it? Could she protect them another 10 years? Could she guard them long enough for them to guard her? And for what? What kind of life is she protecting them for? You're a bad mother, she thinks. For not finding a way to let them know the vastness of the sky. For not finding a way to let them run free in the yard, the street, the neighborhood of empty homes and weathered parked cars. Or granting them a single peek, just once, into space. When the sky turns black and is suddenly beautifully spotted with stars. You are saving their lives for a life not worth living. Mallory sees the drapes soften another degree through blurred, teary vision. If there is a fog out there, it won't be for long. And if it can help her, if it hides her and the children as they go to the river, to the rowboat, then she has to wake them now. She slams a hand against the kitchen table, then wipes her eyes dry. Rising and leaving the kitchen, Mallory takes the hall and enters the children's bedroom. Boy, she yells. Girl, get up. The bedroom is dark. The one window is covered with enough blankets so that even at its zenith, sunlight does not get through. There are two mattresses, one on each side of the room. Above them are black domes. Once, the chicken wire that supports the domes was used to fence in a small garden by the well in the home's backyard. But for the past 4 years, it has served as armor, protecting the children not from what could see them, but from what they could see. Beneath it, Mallory hears movement, and she kneels to loosen the wire that's fastened to nails in the room's wood floor. She is already pulling from her pocket the blindfolds as the two children look at her with sleepy, surprised expressions.
Mommy?
Get up, now. Mommy needs you to move fast. The children respond quickly. They do not whine or complain.
Where are we going?
The girl asks. Mallory hands her a blindfold and says, Put this on. We're going on the river. The pair take their blindfolds and tie the black cloth tightly over their eyes. They are well versed in the motion. Experts. If at 4 years old, they can be experts in anything. It breaks Mallory's heart. They are only children and should be curious. They should be asking her why, today, they are going on the river, a river they have never been on before. But instead, they just do as they are told. Mallory does not put on her own blindfold yet. She will get the kids ready first.
Bring your puzzles, she tells the girl, and both of you bring your blankets.
The excitement she feels is unnameable. It's much more like hysteria. Stepping from one room to another, Mallory checks for things, small items they might need. Suddenly, she feels horribly unprepared. She feels unsafe, as though the house and the earth beneath it just vanished, exposing her to the outside world entirely. Yet in the mania of the moment, she holds tight to the concept of the blindfold. No matter what tools she might pack, no matter what household object might be used as a weapon, she knows that the blindfolds are the strongest protection. Bring your blankets, she reminds them, hearing the two small bodies ready themselves. Then she steps into their room to assist them. The boy, small for his age, but with a wiry strength Mallory takes pride in, is deciding between two shirts that are both too large for him. They once belonged to an adult, long since gone. Mallory chooses for him and watches as his dark hair vanishes within the cloth, then sprouts again through the head hole. In her anxious state, Mallory recognizes that the boy has grown some recently. The girl, average-sized for her age, is attempting to pull a dress over her head, a dress she and Mallory sewed from an old bedsheet.
There's a chill in the air, girl. A dress won't do.
The girl frowns. Her blonde hair is messy from her having just woken up.
I'll wear pants too, Mommy. And we've got our blankets.
Anger flares in Mallory. She doesn't want any resistance. Not today. Not even if the girl is right.
No dresses today.
The world outside. The empty malls and restaurants. The thousands of unused vehicles. The forgotten products on idle store shelves. All of it presses in on the house. It all whispers of what awaits them. She takes a coat from the closet in the small bedroom down the hall from the children. Then she leaves the room, for what she knows will be the last time.
Mommy?
The girl says, meeting her in the hall.
Do we need our bicycle horns?
Mallory breathes deep.
No, she answers. We'll all be together, the whole trip.
As the girl steps back into the bedroom, Mallory thinks of how pathetic it is, that bicycle horns are her children's greatest entertainment. They've played with them for years. All of their lives, honking from across the living room. The loud sound used to put Mallory on edge. But she never took them away, never hid them. Even in the throes of early anxious motherhood, Mallory understood that in this world, anything that brought the children to giggle was a good thing, even when they used to frighten Victor with them. Oh, how Mallory longs for that dog. In the early days of raising the children alone, her fantasies of taking the river included Victor, the border collie, seated beside her in the rowboat. Victor would have warned her if an animal were near. He might have been capable of frightening something away. "Okay," she says, her lithe body in the doorframe of the children's bedroom. "That's it. Now we go." There were times, placid afternoons, tempestuous evenings, when Mallory told them this day might come. Yes, she had spoken of the river before, of a trip. She was careful never to call it their escape, because she couldn't bear their believing their daily lives were something to flee from. Instead, she cautioned them of a future morning when she would wake them hastily, demanding they prepare to leave their home forever. She knew they would detect her uncertainty, just as they could hear a spider crawling up the glass pane of a draped window. For years, there sat a small pouch of food in the cupboard, set aside until it went stale, always replaced, always replenished. Mallory's proof, her evidence that she might wake them as she told them she would. "You see," she would think, nervously checking the drapes. "The food in the cupboard is part of a plan." And now, the day has come. This morning, this hour, the fog. The boy and the girl step forward and Mallory kneels before them. She checks their blindfolds. They are secure. In that moment, looking from one small face to the other, Mallory comprehends fully that at last, the journey out has begun. "Listen to me," she tells them, grasping their chins. "We're going to take a rowboat along the river today. It could be a long trip, but it's crucial that you both do every single thing I say. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Yes." "It's cold out there. You have your blankets. You have your folds. There is nothing more you need right now. Do you understand me?"
"Yes."
"Yes. Under no circumstances will either one of you remove your blindfold. If you do, I will hurt you. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Yes. I need your ears. I need you both to listen as carefully as you can. On the river, you need to listen beyond the water, beyond the woods. If you hear an animal in those woods, tell me. If you hear anything in the water, you tell me. Understand?"
"Yes."
"Yes. Do not ask questions that have nothing to do with the river. You'll be sitting up front," she says, tapping the boy. Then she taps the girl, "and you'll be sitting in the back. When we get to the boat, I'll guide you to those places. I'll be in the middle, rowing. I don't want you two talking across the boat to one another unless it's about something you hear in the woods or the river. Understand?"
"Yes."
"Yes. We are not stopping for any reason. Not until we get to where we're going. I'll let you know when that is. If you get hungry, eat from this pouch." Mallory brings the pouch to the back of their small hands. "Don't fall asleep. Do not fall asleep. I need your ears more now today than I've ever needed them."
"Will we bring the microphones?"
the girl asks. "No." As Mallory speaks, she looks from one blindfolded face to the other. "When we leave this house, we'll hold hands and walk along the path to the well. We'll go through the small clearing in the woods behind our house. The path to the river is overgrown,
We may have to drop hands for a step, and if we do, I want you both to hold on to my coat or each other's. Understand?
Yes.
Yes.
Do they sound scared? Listen to me. We're going somewhere neither of you has ever been. We're going farther from the house than you've gone before. There are things out there that will hurt you, that will hurt Mommy if you do not listen to me now, this morning. The children are silent. Do you understand?
Yes.
Yes.
Mallory has trained them well. All right, she says, her voice revealing a hint of hysteria. We're going. We're going right now. We're going. She presses their heads against her forehead. Then she takes each child by the hand. They cross the house quickly. In the kitchen, Mallory, trembling, wipes her eyes and pulls her own blindfold from her pocket. She ties it tight around her head and dark long hair. She pauses, her hand on the doorknob, the door that opens to the path she has taken for countless buckets of water. She is about to leave the house behind. The reality of this moment overwhelms her. When she opens the door, the cool air rushes in and Mallory steps forward. Her mind's eye blurry with terror and scenarios too ghastly to speak of in front of the children. She stammers as she speaks, nearly yelling as she does.
Hold my hands! Both of you!
The boy takes Mallory's left hand. The girl slips her tiny fingers into her right. Blindfolded, they step from the house. The well is 20 yards away. Small pieces of wood, once part of picture frames, outline the path, placed there for direction. Both children have touched the wood with the tip of their shoes countless times. Mallory once told them that the water in the well was the only medicine they'd ever need. Because of this, Mallory knows, the children have always respected the well. They never complained about fetching water with her. At the well now, the ground is bumpy beneath their feet. It feels unnatural, soft.
Here's the clearing,
Mallory calls. She leads the children carefully. A second path begins 10 yards from the well. The entrance to this path is narrow, and it splits the woods. The river is less than 100 yards from here. At the woods, Mallory momentarily lets go of the children's hands so she can feel for the scant entry.
Hold on to my coat.
She feels along the branches until she finds a tank top, tied to a tree at the path's entrance. She tied it here herself more than 3 years ago. The boy grabs hold of her pocket and she senses the girl take hold of his. Mallory calls to them as she walks, constantly asking them if they are holding on to one another. Tree branches poke her in the face. She does not cry out. Soon, they arrive at the marker Mallory has stuck in the dirt. The splintered leg of a kitchen chair, stuck in the center of the path, there for her to trip on, to stumble over, to recognize. She discovered the rowboat 4 years ago, docked only 5 houses from their own. It has been more than a month since she last checked on it, but she believes it is still there. Still, it is difficult not to imagine the worst. What if someone else got to it first? Another woman, not unlike herself, living 5 houses in the other direction, using every day of 4 years to gather enough courage to flee. A woman who once stumbled down this same slippery bank and felt the same point of salvation, the pointed steel tip of the rowboat. The air nips at the scratches on Mallory's face. The children do not complain.
This is not childhood,
Mallory thinks, leading them toward the river.
Then she hears it.
Before reaching the dock, she hears the rowboat rocking in the water. She stops and checks the children's blindfolds, tightening both.
She leads them onto the wood planks.
Yes, she thinks. It's still here.
Just like the cars are still parked in the street outside their house. Just like the homes on the street are still empty. It is colder, out of the woods, away from the house. The sound of the water is as frightening as it is exhilarating. Kneeling where she believes the boat must be, she lets go of the children's hands and feels for the steel tip. Her fingertips find the rope that holds it first.
Boy,
she says, pulling the ice-cold tip of the boat toward the dock.
In the front. Get in the front.
She helps him. Once he is steady, she holds his face in both her hands and says once again, Listen, beyond the water. Listen. She tells the girl to stay on the dock as she blindly unties the rope, before carefully climbing onto the middle bench. Still half-standing, she helps the girl aboard. The boat rocks once violently, and Mallory grips the girl's hand too tight. The girl does not cry out. There are leaves, sticks, and water in the bottom of the boat. Mallory sifts through them to find the paddle she has stowed on the boat's right side. The paddles are cold, damp. They smell of mildew. She sets them into the steel grooves. They feel strong, sturdy, as she uses one to push off from the dock. And then, they are on the river. The water is calm, but there are sounds out here. Movement in the woods. Mallory thinks of the fog. She hopes it has hidden their escape. But the fog will go away.
Children,
Mallory says, breathing hard.
Listen.
Finally, after 4 years of waiting, training, and finding the courage to leave, she paddles away from the dock, from the bank, and from the house that has protected her and the children for what feels like a lifetime. 2. It is 9 months before the children are born. Mallory lives with her sister, Shannon, in a modest rental neither of them has decorated. They moved in 3 weeks ago, despite their friends' concerns. Mallory and Shannon are both popular, intelligent women, but in each other's company, they have a tendency to become unglued, as shown the very day they carried their boxes inside. I was thinking it makes more sense for me to have the bigger bedroom, Shannon said, standing on the second floor landing, seeing as I've got the bigger dresser.
Oh, come on, Mallory responded, holding a milk crate of unread books. That room has a better window.
The sisters debated this for a long time, both wary of proving their friends and family right by erupting in an argument on their first afternoon. Eventually, Mallory agreed to a coin toss, which ended in Shannon's favor, an event Mallory still believes was somehow fixed. Now, today, Mallory is not thinking about the little things her sister does that drive her batty. She is not quietly cleaning up after Shannon, closing cabinet doors, following her trail of sweaters and socks through the halls. She is not huffing passively, shaking her head as she runs the dishwasher or slides one of Shannon's unpacked boxes from the center of the living room, where it's in both of their way. Instead, she is standing before the mirror in the first floor bathroom, where she is naked, as she studies her belly in the glass. You've missed a period before, she tells herself. But this is hardly consolation, because she has been anxious for weeks now, knowing she should have been safer with Henry Martin. Her black hair hangs to her shoulders. Her lips curl down in a curious frown. She places her hands on her flat belly and nods slowly. No matter how she explains herself, she feels pregnant.
Mallory, Shannon calls from the living room. What are you doing in there?
Mallory does not respond. She turns sideways and tilts her head.
Her blue eyes look gray in the pale light of the bathroom. She plants a palm on the sink's pink linoleum and arches her back. She is trying to make her belly skinnier, as if this might prove there could be no little life within it.
Mallory! Shannon calls again. There's another report on television. Something happened in Alaska.
Mallory hears her sister, but what's going on in the outside world doesn't matter much to her right now. In recent days, the internet has blown up with a story people are calling the Russia Report. In it, a man who was riding in the passenger seat of a truck driving along a snowy highway outside St. Petersburg asked his friend who was driving to pull over and then attacked him, removing his lips with his fingernails. Then he took his own life in the snow, using a table saw from the truck bed. A grisly story, but one whose notoriety Mallory attributes to the seemingly senseless way the internet has of making random occurrences famous. But then, a second story appeared. Similar circumstances. This time in Yakutsk, some 5,000 miles east of St. Petersburg. There, a mother, by all accounts stable, buried her children alive in the family's garden before taking her own life with the jagged edges of broken dishes. And a third story, in Omsk, Russia, nearly 2,000 miles southeast of St. Petersburg, sprouted online and quickly became one of the most discussed topics on all social media sites. This time, there was video footage. For as long as she could, Mallory had watched a man wielding an axe, his beard red with blood, trying to attack the unseen man who filmed him. Eventually, he succeeded. But Mallory didn't see that part. She tried not to follow any more on the subject at all. But Shannon, always more dramatic, insisted on relaying the frightening news.
Alaska, Shannon repeats through the bathroom door. That's America, Mallory.
Shannon's blonde hair betrays their mother's Finnish roots. Mallory looks more like her father. Strong, deep-set eyes and the smooth, fair skin of a northerner. Having been raised in the Upper Peninsula, both dreamed of living downstate near Detroit, where they imagined there were parties, concerts, job opportunities, and men in abundance. This last item hadn't proved fruitful for Mallory until she met Henry Martin.
Holy shit, Shannon hollers. There might have been something in Canada, too. This is serious stuff, Mallory. What are you doing in there?
Mallory turns on the faucet and lets the cool water run over her fingers. She splashes some on her face. Looking up into the mirror, she thinks of her parents, still in the Upper Peninsula. They haven't heard of Henry Martin. She hasn't even spoken to him since their one night. Yet here she is, probably tied to him forever. Suddenly the bathroom door opens. Mallory reaches for a towel.
Geez, Shannon.
Did you hear me, Mallory? The story is everywhere. People are starting to say it's related to seeing something. Isn't that strange? I just heard CNN say it's the one constant in all the incidents. That the victims saw something before attacking people and taking their own lives. Can you believe this? Can you? Mallory turns slowly to her sister. Her face carries no expression. Hey, are you all right, Mallory? You don't look so good. Mallory starts crying. She bites her lower lip. She has grabbed the towel but has yet to cover herself. She is still standing before the mirror as if examining her naked belly. Shannon notices this.
Oh, shit, Shannon says. Are you worried that you're...
Mallory is already nodding. The sisters step to each other in the pink bathroom, and Shannon holds Mallory, patting the back of her black hair, soothing her.
Okay, she says, let's not freak out. Let's go get a test. That's what people do, okay?
Don't worry. I bet you more than half the people who get tests wind up not being pregnant.
Mallory doesn't respond. She only sighs deeply.
Okay, Shannon says. Let's go.
3. How far can a person hear?
Rowing blindfolded is even harder than Mallory had imagined. Many times already, the rowboat has run into the banks and gotten stuck for a period of several minutes. In that time, she was besieged by visions of unseen hands reaching for the blindfolds that cover the children's eyes. Fingers coming up and out of the water, from the mud where the river meets the earth. The children did not scream. They did not whine. They are too patient for that.
But how far can a person hear?
The boy helped get the boat loose, standing and pushing against a mossy trunk. And now Mallory paddles again. Despite these early setbacks, Mallory can feel they are making progress. It is invigorating. Birds sing in the trees now that the sun has come up. Animals roam amid the thick foliage of the woods that surround them. Fish jump out of the water, making small splashes that electrify Mallory's nerves. All of this is heard. None of it is seen. From birth, the children have been trained to understand the sounds of the forest. As babies, Mallory would tie t-shirts over their eyes and carry them to the edge of the woods. There, despite knowing they were too young to understand any of what she told them, she would describe the sounds of the forest.
Leaves crinkling, she would say. A small animal, like a rabbit.
Always aware that it could be something much worse. Worse even than a bear. In those days, and the days that followed, when the children were old enough to learn, Mallory trained herself as she trained them. But she would never hear as well as they one day would. She was 24 years old before she was able to discern the difference between a raindrop and a tap on a window, relying only on her hearing. She was raised on sight. Did this then make her the wrong teacher? When she carried leaves inside and had the children, blindfolded, identify the difference between her stepping on one and crushing one in her hand, were these the right lessons to give? How far can a person hear? The boy likes fish, she knows. Often Mallory caught one in the river, using a rusted fishing pole fashioned from an umbrella found in the cellar. The boy enjoyed watching them splash in the well bucket in the kitchen. He took to drawing them, too. Mallory remembers thinking she'd have to catch every beast on the planet and bring it home for the children to know what they looked like. What else might they like if given the chance to view it? What would the girl think of a fox? A raccoon? Even cars were a myth, with only Mallory's amateur drawings as reference. Boots, bushes, gardens, storefronts, buildings, streets, and stars. Why, she would have had to recreate the globe for them. But the best they got was fish, and the boy loved them. Now, on the river, hearing another small splash, she worries lest his curiosity inspire him to remove his fold. How far can a person hear? Mallory needs the children to hear into the trees, into the wind, into the dirt banks that lead to an entire world of living creatures. The river is an amphitheater, Mallory muses, paddling. But it's also a grave. The children must listen. Mallory cannot stave off the visions of hands emerging from the darkness, clutching the heads of the children, deliberately untying that which protects them. Breathing hard and sweating, Mallory prays a person can hear all the way to safety.
4.
Mallory is driving. The sisters use her car, a 1999 Ford Festiva, because there is more gas in it.
They are only 3 miles from home, yet already there are signs that things have changed.
Look, Shannon says, pointing at several houses. Blankets over the windows.
Mallory is trying to pay attention to what Shannon is saying, but her thoughts keep returning to her belly. The Russia Report media explosion worries her, but she does not take it as seriously as her sister. Others online are, like Mallory, more skeptical. She's read blogs, particularly silly people, that post photos of people taking precautions, then add funny captions beneath them. As Shannon alternately points out the window, then shields her eyes, Mallory thinks of one. It was of a woman hanging a blanket over her window. Beneath it, the caption read, "Honey, what do you think of us moving the bed right here?"
"Can you believe it?" Shannon says.
Mallory nods silently. She turns left.
"Come on," Shannon says. "You absolutely have to admit. This is getting interesting."
A part of Mallory agrees. It is interesting. On the sidewalk, a couple passes with newspaper held to their temples. Some drivers have their rearview mirrors turned up. Distantly, Mallory wonders if these are the signs of a society beginning to believe something is wrong. And if so, what?
"I don't understand," Mallory says, partly trying to distract her thoughts and partly gaining interest.
"Don't understand what?"
"Do they think it's unsafe to look outside? To look anywhere?"
"Yes," Shannon says. "That's exactly what they think. I've been telling you."
Shannon, Mallory thinks, has always been dramatic.
"Well, that sounds insane," she says. "And look at that guy."
Shannon looks to where Mallory points. Then she looks away. A man in a business suit walks with a blind man's walking stick. His eyes are closed.
"Nobody's ashamed to act like this," Shannon says, her eyes on her shoes. "That's how weird it's gotten."
When they pull into Stokely's Drugs, Shannon is holding her hand up to shield her eyes. Mallory notices, then looks across the parking lot.
Others are doing the same.
"What are you worried about seeing?" she asks.
"Nobody knows that answer yet."
Mallory has seen the drugstore's big yellow sign 1,000 times, but it has never looked so uninviting.
"Let's go buy your first pregnancy test," she thinks, getting out of the car.
The sisters cross the lot.
"They're by the medicine, I think,"
Shannon whispers, opening the store's front door, still covering her eyes.
"Shannon, stop it."
Mallory leads the way to the family planning aisle. There is First Response, Clear Blue Easy, New Choice, and 6 other brands.
"There are so many of them," Shannon says, taking one from the shelf. "Doesn't anyone use condoms anymore?"
"Which one do I get?"
Shannon shrugs.
"This one looks as good as any."
A man farther down the aisle opens a box of bandages. He holds one up to his eye. The sisters bring the test to the counter. Andrew, who is Shannon's age and once asked her on a date, is working. Mallory wants this moment to be over with.
"Wow,"
Andrew says, scanning the small box.
"Shut up, Andrew," Shannon says. "It's for our dog."
"You guys have a dog now?"
"Yes,"
Shannon says, taking the bag he's put it in. "And she's very popular in our neighborhood." The drive home is torturous for Mallory. The plastic bag between their seats suggests her life has already changed.
"Look," Shannon says, pointing out the car window with the same hand she's been using to hide her eyes.
The sisters come to a stop sign slowly. Outside the corner house, they see a woman on a small ladder, nailing a comforter over the home's bay window.
"When we get back, I'm doing the same thing," Shannon says.
Shannon.
Their street, usually crowded with the neighborhood kids, is empty. No blue stickered tricycle. No wiffle ball bats. Once inside, Mallory heads to the bathroom, and Shannon immediately turns on the television.
I think all you gotta do is pee on it, Mallory, Shannon calls.
Inside the bathroom, Mallory can hear the news. By the time Shannon arrives at the bathroom door, Mallory is already staring at the pink strip, shaking her head.
Oh, boy, Shannon says.
I've got to call Mom and Dad, Mallory says. A part of her is already steeling herself, knowing that despite being single, she is going to have this baby.
You need to call Henry Martin, Shannon says.
Mallory looks to her sister quickly. All day she's known Henry Martin will not play a big part in the raising of this child. In a way, she's already accepted this. Shannon walks with her to the living room, where boxes of unpacked objects clutter the space in front of the television. On the screen is a funeral procession. CNN anchormen are discussing it. Shannon steps to the television and lowers the volume. Mallory sits on the couch and calls Henry Martin from her cell phone. He does not answer, so she texts him.
Important stuff. Call me when you can.
Suddenly, Shannon springs up from the couch and hollers.
Did you see that, Mallory? An incident in Michigan. I think they said it was in the Upper Peninsula.
Their parents are already on Mallory's mind. As Shannon raises the volume again, the sisters learn that an elderly couple from Iron Mountain were found hanging from a tree in the nearby woods. The anchorman says they used their belts. Mallory calls her mother. She picks up after two rings.
Mallory!
Mom,
I'm sure you're calling because of this news?
No. I'm pregnant, Mom.
Oh, goodness, Mallory.
Her mother is quiet for a moment. Mallory can hear her television in the background.
Are you serious with someone?
No, it was an accident.
Shannon is standing in front of the television now. Her eyes are wide. She is pointing toward it, as though reminding Mallory how important it is. Her mother is quiet on the phone.
Are you okay, Mom? Well, I'm more concerned with you right now, dear.
Yeah, bad timing all around.
How far along are you?
5 weeks, I think. Maybe six.
And you're going to keep it? You've already made this decision?
I am. I mean, I just found out minutes ago. But I am. Yes.
Have you let the father know?
I wrote him. I'll call him, too.
Now Mallory pauses, then continues.
Do you feel safe up there, Mom? Are you okay?
I don't know. I just don't know. None of us do.
We're very scared.
But right now, I'm more worried about you.
On the screen, a woman using a diagram explains what may have happened. She is drawing a line from a small road where the couple's car was found abandoned. Mallory's mother is telling her that she knows someone who knew the elderly couple. Their last name is Mykonin, she is saying. The woman on screen is now standing in what looks like a patch of bloodied grass.
God, Shannon says. Oh, I wish your father were home, their mother is saying.
And you're pregnant. Oh, Mallory.
Shannon is grabbing the phone. She is asking if their mother knows any more details than the news. What are people saying up there? Is this the only incident? Are people taking precautions? As Shannon continues to talk wildly into the phone, Mallory gets up from the couch. She steps to the front door and opens it. Looking up and down the street, she thinks to herself,
How serious is this? There are no neighbors in their yards. No faces in the windows of the other homes. A car drives by, and Mallory cannot see the face of the driver. He is hiding it with his hand. On the grass by the front walk is this morning's newspaper. Mallory steps to it. The front page headline is about the growing number of incidents. It simply says, "Another one." Shannon has probably already told her everything the paper has to say. Mallory picks it up, and turning it over, stops at something on the back page. It's a classified. A home in Riverbridge is opening its doors to strangers. A safe house, it says. A refuge. A place the owners hope will act as a sanctuary as the grim news mounts daily. Mallory, experiencing the first real prickling feelings of panic, looks again to the street. She sees the door to a neighbor's home open, then close quickly. Still holding the paper, Mallory looks over her shoulder back to her house, where the sounds of the television still blare. Inside, at the far wall of the living room, Shannon is tacking a blanket over one of the room's windows. "Come on," Shannon says. "Get in here and close that door." 5. It is 6 months before the children are born. Mallory is showing. Blankets cover every window in the house. The front door is never left unlocked and never left open. Reports of unexplainable events have been surfacing with an alarming frequency. What was once breaking news twice a week now develops every day. Government officials are interviewed on television. Stories from as far east as Maine, as far south as Florida, have both sisters now taking precautions. Shannon, who visits dozens of blogs daily, fears a mishmash of ideas, a little bit of everything she reads. Mallory doesn't know what to believe. New stories appear hourly online. It's the only thing anybody talks about on social media, and it's the only topic on the news pages. New websites are devoted entirely to the evolution of information on the subject. One site features only a global map, with small red faces placed upon the cities in which something occurred. Last time Mallory checked, there were more than 300 faces. Online, they are calling it the problem. There exists the widespread communal belief that whatever the problem is, it definitely begins when a person sees something. Mallory resisted believing it as long as she could. The sisters argued constantly, Mallory citing the pages that derided mass hysteria, Shannon citing everything else. But soon, Mallory had to relent. When the pages she frequented began to run stories about their own loved ones, and the authors of these blogs stepped forward to admit some concern. Cracks, Mallory thought then, showing even in the skeptics. Days passed in which Mallory experienced a sort of double life. Neither sister left the house anymore. Both made sure the windows were covered. They watched CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News until they physically couldn't watch the same stories repeating themselves. And while Shannon grew more serious and even grave, Mallory held on to a pinch of hope that this would all simply go away. But it didn't, and it got worse. 3 months into living like shut-ins, Mallory and Shannon's worst fears came true when their parents stopped answering their phone. They didn't answer emails either. Mallory wanted to drive north to the Upper Peninsula, but Shannon refused. "We're just going to have to hope they're being safe, Mallory. We're going to have to hope their phone was shut off. Driving anywhere right now would be dumb, even to the store. And driving 9 hours would be suicide." The problem always resulted in suicide. Fox News had reported the word so often that they were now using synonyms. Self-destruction, self-immolation, harikari. One anchorman described it as personal erasing, a phrase that did not catch on. Instructions from the government were reprinted on the screen. A national curfew was mandated. People were advised to lock their doors, cover their windows, and above all, not to look outside. On the radio, music was replaced entirely with discussions.
A blackout, Mallory thinks. The world, the outdoors, is being shut down.
Nobody has answers. Nobody knows what is going on. People are seeing something that drives them to hurt others, to hurt themselves. People are dying. But why? Mallory tries to calm down by focusing on the child growing inside her. She seems to be encountering every symptom mentioned in her baby book with child. Slight bleeding, tender breasts, fatigue. Shannon points out Mallory's mood swings, but it's the cravings that are driving her crazy. Too afraid to drive to the store, the sisters are stuck with the items they stockpiled shortly after purchasing the pregnancy test. But Mallory's tastes have changed. Standard foods disgust her. So she combines things. Orange brownies. Chicken with cocktail sauce. Raw fish on toast. She dreams of ice cream. Often, looking toward the front door, she thinks of how easy it would be to get behind the wheel of the car and drive to the store. She knows it would take only 15 minutes. But every time she leans toward doing it, the television delivers another harrowing story. And besides, who knows if the employees show up to the stores anymore?
What do you think people are seeing?
Mallory asks Shannon.
I don't know, Mal. I just don't know.
The sisters ask each other this question constantly. It'd be impossible to count the number of theories that have been birthed online. All of them scare the hell out of Mallory. Mental illness as a result of the radio waves and wireless technology is one. An erroneous evolutionary leap in humankind is another. New Agers say it's a matter of humanity being in touch with a planet that is close to exploding, or a sun that is dying. Some people believe there are creatures out there. The government is saying nothing except lock your doors. Mallory, alone, sits on the couch, slowly rubbing her belly, watching television. She worries that there is nothing positive to watch, that the baby feels her anxiety. With child told her this would happen. The baby will experience the mother's emotions. Still, she can't look away from the screen. On a desk against the wall behind her, the computer is open and on. The radio plays softly. Together, it makes Mallory feel like she's in a war room. At the center of it all, while everything is falling apart. It's overwhelming. And it's becoming terrifying. There are no commercials anymore. And the newscasters pause for periods of time, shamelessly revealing their surprise as they receive updates on air. Above this buzzing din of media, Mallory hears Shannon moving on the second floor. Then, as Gabriel Townes, one of CNN's primary anchors, silently reads a sheet of paper just handed to him, Mallory hears a thud from above. She pauses.
Shannon? She calls. Are you all right?
Gabriel Townes doesn't look good. He's been on television a lot lately. CNN let it be known that many of their reporters have stopped coming into the station. Townes has been sleeping there.
We'll go through this together, is his new slogan.
His hair is no longer perfect. He wears little makeup. More jarring is the exhausted way in which he delivers the news. He looks sunken.
Shannon, come down here. It looks like Townes just got an update.
but there is no response. There is only silence from upstairs.